This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today, two very different books linked by the slenderest thread of history. First, we talk with Les Leopold about his uncle's remarkable diary of life as a Jew in Nazi Germany. It's called Defiant German, Defiant Jew, a Holocaust memoir from inside the Third Reich. Then we talk with acclaimed crime novelist Anthony Horowitz about his newest murder mystery confection, The Moonflower Murders. And that slender thread of history? One of his characters is sleuth Atticus Punt, a German Jew who survived Nazi Germany. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. 82 years ago this week, the end stage of Germany's pre-war Jewish community began. On the night of November 10th to 11th, the Nazis carried out a pogrom that ransacked thousands of German homes, synagogues, and shops. 30,000 Jewish men were taken away to concentration camps, among them my guest Les Leopold's Uncle Walter, who spent several months in Buchenwald before being miraculously released. Walter Leopold was a self-declared revolutionary Jew who kept a remarkable diary all through the years of living first in hiding and then under an assumed identity until the end of the war. Against all odds, he, his wife, and his young daughter managed to survive as he fought in any way he could against fascism. Walter Leopold died when his American nephew, Les Leopold, was only 3. But like his uncle Walter, Les Leopold is a fighter against injustice. Writer's Voice listeners know him from the multiple times we've interviewed him about his books on income inequality, including The Looting of America and Runaway Inequality. When he discovered his uncle's diary, he was struck by its relevance to today. He knew he had to bring it to American readers. Hence the memoir, Defiant German, Defiant Jew. Well, Les Leopold, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
This is a remarkable wartime diary by your uncle, Walter Leopold, from inside the Third Reich, to which you've added a lot of needed and excellent context. It's brilliantly written. I'd like to start out by quoting from one of his paragraphs in the memoir, just to give our listeners a sense of your uncle's voice. He writes about the kind of terrible sense of threat and precariousness, once the Nazis took over. He says, "Whoever flits with wife and child from one hiding place to another for a whole year to save his life becomes hypersensitive. Sensitive not only to the dangers constantly lurking around him, but also to the remarks of those around him, confidently trusting in the nature of his asylum givers and grateful for the self-sacrificing courage of his friends. He flutters like a feather in a gentle breath of air, registers high and low pressure like a barometer, and the warmth of his providers like a thermometer. He looks eagerly for every ray of hope, like a prisoner grasping with trembling fingers for a sunbeam which may stray into his cell as if it were a lifeline." I mean, really remarkable language.
Yeah, that is a very telling passage. And you just feel with him, here he is with his wife and his child, sort of kind of stuck in one room in basically a stranger's apartment. And the feelings, the emotions that, I mean, he can't do anything. You know, they're hiding. They can't do anything. You can just imagine every word that's being uttered. You know, when they got together to talk and with the family that they were with, you could just imagine all the tensions that exist. I mean, you know, imagine someone in your apartment, and if the Gestapo finds out about it, they're dead, you're dead. I mean, it's just, the tension is just enormous. And you picked a great passage there. You can just see how sensitive he was to what was going on around him, that he could see out while he's feeling all these things and then describe them, I thought this is what totally captured me. That was an excellent example. Just one after the other, I just thought, oh my God, who is this guy? This is just incredible. Yeah, I was waiting for the espionage, the intrigue, and what I got was real life instead of a Netflix drama. And that passage in particular, I remind myself of the difference between what they went through and what we're going through with COVID. And actually, it's a great blessing that he's given me and others that may read it, because you can compare what we're going through, the lockdown, and we can't go out and we can't see our friends. And I'm thinking, you know what? This is nothing compared to what they went through. I mean, yes, it's inconvenient, et cetera, but, compared to really being holed up for over a year underground, and then for another year under a false identity, where one slip of the tongue means death, is just keeps things into perspective.
So we are airing this on the roughly around the 82nd anniversary of Kristallnacht, which happened November 9th to 10th, 1938. The day after Kristallnacht, Walter, along with several hundred other men from Leipzig, where he was from, were sent to the dreaded Buchenwald concentration camp. Tell us about that. Tell us about what happened.
Well, the first thing to note about what happened is, what the hell is he still doing in Germany in 1938? He was the most professional, esteemed man in my father's family. My father got out. His brother, the middle brother, got out. My mother got her whole family out starting in 1933. But Walter held on. I think he viewed himself as part of the anti-fascist movement in Germany. And I think by the time he decided to get out, maybe, this we're not sure of, it was too late, way too late. Anyway, so he's still there. And he gets hauled to Buchenwald, and he somehow is taking notes. He's actually, while he's there, writing down what he sees. And it is shocking. This is pre, crematoriums. This is pre, the gas chambers. But the viciousness of, the Nazi guards and what they're doing, he sees them tear off a beard of a rabbi right in front of him. He sees a body thrown into a bear pit. By the way, there were rumors of this, but as far as I know, my uncle may be the first person. This is the diary, maybe the firsthand description of this. They throw a body into a pit where these bears are, and the bear rips up the body, and then they bring in these vultures from the aviary that they had there to eat the parts. This is what he's seeing, and he's describing the details of where they sleep and their food, or the lack of food. And he has no idea what's going to happen to him. And then a sort of a remarkable thing does happen. He hears, first the rumor is that they're going to get out, within a few weeks, then in a few months, and then within 6 months. And he's actually writing about how he's actually starting to feel sorry for himself. Again, another, his self reflections and his ability to understand himself, I thought, it's remarkable. Most people, when they feel sorry for themselves, just feel sorry for themselves, and, aren't really aware that they're slipping into this depression. But he is aware, and he's making notes about it. Anyway, it turns out, this is one thing I did know about him, that he fought in World War I for the Germans. I was always kind of embarrassed about that as a kid. So he fought for the Germans in World War I, along with hundreds of thousands of, I think 100,000 Jews who did the same. And he had received a high-level Iron Cross Medal of Honor for bravery in helping his platoon survive some incredible retreat that they had to do in the Yugoslavian mountains. And he found out that the Germans, actually, Hitler, actually respected people who had gotten the Iron Cross.
For a while.
Yeah. And he finds out that they're starting to let people out that had received an Iron Cross, letting Jews out of Buchenwald who had received an Iron Cross in World War I. Unfortunately, he has no papers with him, no way to say, hey, I've got one of those. So some people are being let out, but not him. And so he's sitting there watching all these horrors around, and people are getting, you know, this one person that was with him gotten an infection in his hand, and then it got worse, and then he just disappears. And they, you know, think that he was one of the people who died. And he's just seeing, you know, brutality also. Anyway, turns out he's in 3+ weeks, and it turns out that his name gets called out, and he gets released. And they tell him, you're getting released. Get out of the country. Go somewhere. Get out. And the other people who were released, he was part of this kind of Jewish administration of Leipzig. Leipzig was a very unusual place. Jews had been there since the Middle Ages as part of a fair, a trade fair called, it was the Leipzig Trade Fair. It was a big deal all over Europe. People came there, Jews came there, and they were given citizenship in the 1700s, 1800s, and they had their own community, collected taxes, ran their own schools. They had a certain autonomous existence. It wasn't a ghetto. It was like a parallel government almost. He was part of that government. And so were others who were arrested and then released. And they all left. He didn't. He could have gone to Palestine. He didn't want to take his family to Palestine because he was very progressive and viewed that as a, you know, another war zone and, you know, somebody else's land, basically. And he didn't want to put his family through what he thought was going to be, you know, another struggle. And he stays. But his insight into, I thought Buchenwald was a quite a remarkable experience for me to read what he saw. It's different than, you know, just your horror stories, all the movies we've seen and accounts that we've read. For me anyway, much more personal to read how he experiences it.
Yeah, and it's also, I think, even more brutal than almost any of the movies. I mean, I remember when I saw Steven Spielberg's movie about Schindler's List, how many Holocaust survivors at the time said it was way worse than that. And it was you know, pretty horrific on the screen. One of the details also that I didn't know about was how Jews had to surrender their pets who were then killed. Their pets were killed. So his dog, Mouse Line, a member of the family, was taken away and murdered.
Yeah, I did a little research on this as well. It turns out that when the war started, the Brits also had 700,000 pets killed because they were worried about a food shortage. And I think it was obviously a more voluntary for the war cause. What they did in Germany was they went after Jewish pets.
Yeah.
Look, the war starts in 1939. They round them up for the concentration camps and put them in the, you know, and gas them after the Wannsee
The Final Solution Conference.
Yeah, the Final Solution Conference. That's not till 1942. So what my uncle is going through is he's still above ground. They're wearing their yellow stars on their sleeves. He's part of this Jewish administration. But the big roundups haven't started yet. But one of the precursors of that was they start rounding up the pets. And he's got to take this Alsatian, you know, big like German Shepherd, their darling. It was their child, basically, until they finally had my cousin in 1937. This was their lovely pet. And he had to take it to a dog pound where the dog was electrocuted.
Jesus.
I mean, you talk about sick.
Yeah.
So they were just doing this to Jewish pets.
Of course. I mean, it was just all part of the cruelty. You know, the cruelty is the point, as we've learned from you know, taking babies away from their mothers at the U.S. border. The cruelty is the point. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Les Leopold about the remarkable Holocaust memoir written by his uncle Walter Leopold, Defiant German, Defiant Jew. Now, you mentioned that he became part of the administration. I mean, he had been part of the Jewish administration before the Nazis took over. And then after the Nazis took over, his job was to collect the so-called exit taxes from those who would be about to be transported to the concentration camp. So talk about what happened when he would go to the homes of soon-to-be deported Jews to assess their valuables.
Well, this is where his insight into German Jews becomes, you know, very profound. They're going to Theresienstadt. They're not going to Buchenwald. They're not going to Auschwitz. They're going to a different kind of camp in Czechoslovakia, I believe, where they're being told it's a work camp. So it's not a death camp. My uncle knows that it's just a stepping stone to a death camp. He's very well informed. There's no doubt in his mind that people who go to these camps, the likelihood of them dying is extremely high.
And he would be right in that.
Yeah, no, he knows about the gas chambers forming now. He's getting reports back. He's got connections. You know, the grapevine that he's part of is keeping him well informed. So when he goes to these houses, he's telling people, what are you doing? Hide your valuables. Don't show them to me. Get rid of them. Put them in hiding. You know, give them to other people. And he's stunned by the fact that people don't want to do this, that they're kind of obeying this Nazi law, even when he's sort of helping them get out of some of it. Then some remarkable things start to happen in that, see, the Nazis, the Gestapo, that are running this deportation, they're using the Jewish leadership to round the people up. I mean, they're sending their troops there, but the actual, you know, keeping track of everything, they're leaning on, they're forcing the Jewish leadership to do the dirty work for them. And so, for example, let's say tomorrow 200 people have been put on a list. You know, that's the way the Nazis do it. They have this very efficient list. 200 people are put on a list, and then they send police out to get them, or they just ask them to show up. And if anybody doesn't show up, they send the Jewish administrators, like my uncle, out to get them. And here's the catch. If they can't find them, then the administrator takes their place and gets deported to a concentration camp. So at one point, somebody doesn't show. They send my uncle out to get that person. And my uncle's running around Leipzig trying to find this person. And he knows that if he can't find them, he's going to take their place and, you know, get on the train and off to the east. And he's running around frantically. My aunt is just about having a heart attack because she knows that good chance he's gone now. And then he comes back empty-handed, but it turns out the person showed up anyway.
This actually leads to a bigger question, probably one of the biggest questions people have been asking for, you know, 70 plus years. And that is, why was there so little Jewish resistance? I mean, there was a bit, you know, there were the Warsaw partisans, there were others, you know, like your uncle, who made individual acts of resistance. Why not more? And do you think that that's just the way it is for most people, or did it have something to do with the position of Jews in Germany?
That's a very good question, and the answer is very complicated. I think the first thing, you have to differentiate two periods, the period after the war starts and the period before the war starts. So let me deal with the period after the war starts, since that's where we kind of have been. Resistance in the home country during World War II, resistance in Nazi Germany proper during World War II, was basically impossible. It was suicidal. There was one Jewish resistance group that attacked Goebbels's anti-Soviet exhibits. They burnt one down. And not only did the 30 or so in this group all get killed. But then they killed another 500 Berlin Jews as punishment on top of that. There were very, very few organized acts of resistance within Nazi Germany proper. And the reason for that, in part, is one, by the time the war started, you know, the number of Jews left inside of Germany was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. There were never that many Jews to begin with. You know, less than 1% of the population was Jewish. So that was one thing. The other thing is, a totalitarian country like Germany, I was actually stunned by the number of bureaucratic checks they had on people. You had to have a pass for everything, for your job, for your food, for your cigarette allotment. When you traveled, you couldn't just go from town to town. You had to have a pass. You couldn't just change your job from Leipzig to Frankfurt. You had to sign out of one labor office into another labor office. You had to have a letter before you left. This was an incredibly tightly controlled society. It's impossible for us to understand how tightly controlled it was through bureaucratic means. Plus, virtually every apartment building had at least one Nazi informant, a member of the party, of the Nazi party, which, you know, was not 5% of the population or less was members of the Nazi party, but they were everywhere. And they really took their job seriously. They watched and they informed. So it was very, very hard to resist. So acts of resistance, the next level of acts of resistance, just saying anything bad about Hitler or the Nazi party or Germany was a death sentence. You could be put to death for, you know, cracking jokes about Hitler. And about 800,000 people in Germany were arrested and put in prison for doing that during the war. So I started to appreciate that what my uncle was doing, which was stirring up anti-Hitler sentiment among Nazis when he switched identities, was actually incredibly courageous on his part and very, very risky. Now, the second part is what happens before 1939. And this is where my uncle's insights, I think, are dive into what you were kind of moving towards, which is what were the German Jews doing just before and after Hitler was into power, which is 33. There's 6 years, 33 to 39, where Hitler is increasing and increasing and increasing his power, but it's still a battle. You know, the communist and socialist parties are still there. The trade unions are still there. And where were the German Jews in this configuration? Well, a lot of them were trying to get out of the country, granted. But my uncle's critique of German Jews was that they aligned themselves with the elites, and they didn't align them. They didn't have any real bonds with working people, with the trade unions, with working class and other progressives in society, that they kind of, most of them felt that the elites would protect them. You know, that they felt that the Germany was not going to retreat back into the, you know, full anti-Semitic pogrom type thing from 100 years earlier, that they had arrived and that the elites would protect them. And my uncle said this was foolish. He writes, you know, I think it's one of the, to me, perhaps the biggest lesson of his whole entire diary is exactly that, which is, you know, who are we actually talking to? Who are we actually connected with? And even though he was, you know, very bourgeois, his wife was, his family was factory owners. He was used to having a comfortable living. You know, he was a PhD in Germany. Being Herr Doctor Leopold was a big deal. A PhD was a very, very prestigious degree. Yet he mingled, he was in political alliances with working class people. And he was talking to people who were not of his milieu, who didn't initially agree with him. He was reaching out. You know, if we want to draw some parallels today, this is the one that I find most compelling, which is today the political strategy of progressives are to round up all the people that agree with you in charge and that let demographics, you know, there'll be more Hispanic people, more young people, and the future will be ours. And we just have to keep doing that, as opposed to, like my mentor, Tony Mazzocchi, taught us, which is, no, you got to reach out and talk to working people that don't already agree with you on everything. But if you talk to them about the fundamentals of how the economy is screwing them, you can begin a conversation, begin to win them over. Well, my uncle was involved in that. He was not a member of the Communist Party or Socialist Party. He was very prideful of his independence, but he worked in alliance with them, and he communicated with them, and they're the people that hit him when he got in trouble. That was his first entree into the living underground. Someone gave him an apartment. They were a progressive trade unionist. That was his connection. And he was really scornful of many, many Jews who were apolitical, or their only politics was, you know, doing the same thing as what the elites did. And the elites just left them high and dry. And he saw that happening. And he was like, you know, just so upset about that. And then it didn't surprise him that people would then be led to slaughter, because they had no way to protect themselves, because they were outside of German society. He did not, this is one more, I think, major point, he did not write off the German people, even during the whole Holocaust. He did not write off the average German person as a lost cause. They were people he thought he could help open their eyes. He didn't give up on people. And it's like, you know, many of us have given up on the Trump people that voted for Obama twice. Come on.
Les Leopold. After the break, we continue our conversation about the memoir he discovered, written by his uncle Walter Leopold, about his life under the Third Reich. It's called Defiant German, Defiant Jew. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for our free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book excerpts and extended interviews. And find us on Facebook at Writer's Voice Radio or Twitter at Writer's Voice. Now back to my interview with Les Leopold. So let's return to this wonderful book, Les Leopold, that you collaborated with your uncle on decades after his death, Defiant German, Defiant Jew, a Holocaust memoir from inside the Third Reich. So as you pointed out, he was able to take on a false identity. And there is a large section in the book that has to do with his attempts to get a job in Bludenz, Austria, basically in the Austrian Alps. And it's quite an agonizing project, and one that poses a whole lot of dilemmas for him. Tell us a little bit about that attempt to get the job, and then getting the job, and then kind of the devil's bargain he finds that he's gotten himself into.
Yeah, this is certainly part of the story that never was told in our family. First of all, here's how he's able to change his identity. Somebody gives him, a comrade, gives him a blank military pass. So he with a lupe and a fine pen, he forges a Nazi seal. He knows what the pass is supposed to look like, which basically says he's ineligible for military service due to heart condition. And he does have a heart condition. So he's able to have a forged military pass under an assumed name. His name is Freiherr in German. And he's living underground in an apartment in 1944 when the heavy bombing raids by the Allies start on Dresden, Leipzig. You know, these are the firebombings, the famous Dresden firebombing. Just before that, they bombed Leipzig a couple of times. And the building he was hiding in took a direct hit. And it was, you know, they somehow survived. The building's on fire. My little cousin is totally, you know, traumatized. He runs out of the building. He always has this his suitcase with him that has his memoirs and his papers. But he runs out and says, "Oh my God, we just arrived here from Mannheim. All my papers have been destroyed. What do I do?" And he's sort of a little bit of a hero because he's helping to put out the fire and et cetera, et cetera. And so he's become a Gentile. He's now a German Gentile from Mannheim. And he picked Mannheim to come from because it had been terribly bombed. And he's hoping that no one's going to be able to check his papers in Mannheim. So he comes out, this butcher takes in about 30, 40 people who are basically without, who are homeless. He gives them temporary shelter and he feeds them. And actually, for the first time in a long time, my cousin's eating and my uncle and aunt are eating good food because they've been skimping clearly by living underground. They've had almost nothing. And he's now part of German society. Now what he's got to do is he's got to parlay his pass, saying this is all I have for my papers. He's got to go to bureaucracy after bureaucracy and get his work permits, his this, his that. And he starts to get relief aid. They're giving him food. They're giving him money. They give him a place to stay. They now have a place to live. So now under this assumed name Freiherr, they're above ground. And he's a master at playing these bureaucracies. You know, there's a part of him that you can't help but feel he doesn't come across arrogant, but he's so smart that he's not afraid of any of these bureaucracies. He just figures he's like very nervous about it, but he figures he can tell the story, stick to it, and make it happen. And he gets all the papers that he needs. But, you know, one close call after the other. Matter of fact, one guy who goes with him into one of the bureaus is carrying a pistol, a friend, just in case something goes wrong, they can shoot their way out of it or commit suicide. You know, that's how hair-raising this is. Everything is life and death. But anyway, he gets his way through this. But he realized, first of all, their daughter is now like can't sleep, you know, screaming in the middle of the night because, you know, these bombs went off like, you know, 20 feet away from her.
And she's 6 years old.
Yeah, 6 years old, right? So he wants to get out of Leipzig. So he's looking for, see if he can find a job. Again, you have to find the job first. Then you get permission to move, get a pass, all this kind of stuff. So he has to get an offer before he can even go check it out. And he and his wife, Hilda, had honeymooned in the Vorarlberg, Austrian Alps area, and found it gorgeous, wonderful. And by this point, after 1938, Austria was part of Germany. It's a province of Germany after the Anschluss, you know, a big plebiscite, and Hitler marched in. And so the Austrians are wildly enthusiastic about the Nazis. Nevertheless, he wants to find a job. So he sees one advertised for an auditor, which he thinks he can bluff his way through because his PhD is in basically liberal arts, but it's kind of public administration. His goal in life was to work for the government, which was, again, a high calling. That was a high prestige job to be a government official under Weimar. And he hoped this was something he always wanted to do. He never quite pulled it off because of the anti-Semitism at the time. But so he thought he could play the role of an auditor. And that's what he claimed his profession was a freelance auditor. And he gets permission to go there. He gets interviewed. These two very cultured Nazis are running this regional government, and they hit it off. They offer him a job, and they say only, and of course you're a member of the Nazi party, aren't you, Herr Freiberg? He goes, no, I'm not. I've never been a member of, you know, any party, et cetera. He says, oh, Herr Freiberg, you know, if only you would just join the party, this would be so easy. You could stay here now, bring your family. You know, he goes, nope, can't do it. Basically, he's saying it's against my religion to join anything.
Literally.
Yeah, that's what he says. And they say, okay, well, don't worry. We'll work something out. We'll just, you know, we'll have to get you checked out, you know, through the, you know, Nazi government channels. So my uncle goes home, and now he is absolutely having a cow, because if they're not going to find the Herr Freiberg of Mannheim, because he doesn't exist. And he's like freaking out that they're going to find out the truth. It's only a matter of time for them to find out the truth. And then they will be either summarily shot or sent to the East, to one of the death camps. I mean, he's dead certain. This guy is a smart guy. He does not BS himself very often about political reality. You know, he sees what's going on. He's not kidding himself. He's not pretending the dangers aren't there, et cetera, et cetera, just making up stuff.
But he does get the job. I mean, I don't think we have time to go through all the backs and forth. And he gets the job. They move to Bludenz. And then there's a kind of psychological crisis that he goes through. Because, and I'm going to quote from again. He says, he writes to himself, nevertheless, what have you become, Walter Leopold? You escaped the danger of slaughter in a miraculous way, but also escaped your community. for who knows how long and are stuck among servile Hitler cronies. You have lost your old honest name and changed. You walk on forbidden paths as a man known to be unknown and yet an officially confirmed Aryan, a pure Jew, and at the same time, a full-blooded race comrade of the Jew bashers.
Oh, it's just, I mean, the first thing to say is, although my uncle's like, he's Jewish, his father was a cantor, he grew up in a Jewish family, he wasn't Orthodox, but he really believed that Jewish values were fundamentally about peace and freedom. So he saw his politics and his religion entwined, and his identity was part of this kind of progressive Jewish community. That's who he was. And here he is now working in a Nazi administration as an Aryan, and everybody's treating him as such. And, you know, it's been so long that he's wondering what, you know, who the hell is he? You know, he, as you read, he really digs into this. I think the reason he's writing this is to try to make sure he still remembers who he is and who he was. You know, it gets very, very complicated and confusing at the end. First of all, you know, this is late in the war. He's fairly certain, you know, he's listening illegally to shortwave radio. He knows the Allies are invading and gaining, and the Germans are going to collapse. Now, think about this. He's not only going through the psychological crisis, he's on in basically inside of Germany that's being invaded by the Allies, and the Nazis are wanting to do a death to the last man. Everybody sacrificed everything to support, you know, the mother country, even if we all have to die. So he's about to get conscripted, you know, where they're taking the sick, the young, the sick, you know, 14-year-olds, everybody into the army, the last gasp to defend the mother, the homeland. And he's able to somehow evade that. That doesn't quite happen. And so he's there. The French come in. The town turns out not to kill itself. All of a sudden, all these rabid Austrian Nazis, who he, you know, really ends up not liking, they all claim they never were Nazis. You know, they're cheering. They put on their traditional Tyrolean clothes. They used to greet each other always with a "Hi Hitler." Now they don't do that anymore, of course. And they greet the French troops. The French troops come in. My uncle comes out of the closet. He's a hero. You know, here's a Jew who survived. And meanwhile, he'd been stirring up anti-Nazi stuff to the point where he almost got turned into the Gestapo and had to kind of get his way out of that. He felt like he'd been vindicated. I survived. My family survived. I stirred up anti-Nazi sentiment wherever I went. I'm a resistance fighter. And he wants now to become part of the reform government of Austria, you know, the government that the French are going to put in, the Allies are going to put in, to clean out the Nazis and build, you know, a true democracy. And what does he find out? He finds out that the French administration are anti-Semitic.
Right. Yes, as we all know, in fact, from the Dreyfus Affair and many other things. And of course, Austria, I mean, famously, Konrad Adenauer, who was the prime minister of, or president of Austria, you know, it came out decades after the war that he had been, you know, in very much part of the Nazi administration. I mean, this is a story that happened in many places. And in fact, we have to point out that the Allies were far more friendly to former Nazis than, of course, they were to communists or socialists who had been, you know, persecuted by the previous administration.
Oh, it gets very, very strange. So my uncle wants to become an Austrian citizen. They said, no, anybody that came to Austria after 1938 has to go back to Germany. He goes, wait a second, I'm a Jew. I was forced underground. They were going to kill me. You're going to send me back to Germany? They said, well, look, you know, you're a German. We don't care that you were Jewish. What do you mean you don't care that I was Jewish? So finally, he gets declared as a stateless person. Here's one little twist of how crazy it got. Slowly, concentration camp victims who survived, the few who survived, trickle back from the east. And there's a couple of dozen or whatever come back into his area of Austria. And I think it was in Innsbruck, they formed a committee of concentration camp survivors. And he goes, he wants to join the committee of concentration camp survivors. They say, no, you can't. You're not an Austrian. You're a German. Then it turns out, catch this, the head of the concentration camp survivor committee was a Nazi guard, an Austrian Nazi guard that finally got exposed. So like life is just absolutely maddening for him now, because he tries to become part of the Social Democratic Party. And they, at first, they want to run him for office. And then they say, nope, you're a German. You can't become part of this. And it's just effort after effort. He now spends years trying to become basically a political citizen of this area of Austria. And he gets refused again and again and again. And finally, you know, he realizes he's got to leave. And my mother actually helps him make it to the United States, 1947.
Wow, what a story. And the story is Defiant German, Defiant Jew, a Holocaust memoir from inside the Third Reich. Les Leopold, this has just been absolutely spellbinding talking with you about this book. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Les Leopold is the author of numerous books, including The Looting of America and Runaway Inequality. Leopold has turned the book Runaway Inequality into an ongoing project that trains tens of thousands of trade unionists about predatory capitalism and how to fight it. Go to writersvoice.net to find our other interviews with him. Next up, the newest murder mystery from Master Anthony Horowitz. Anthony Horowitz is one of the world's best-selling authors of crime fiction. I always delight in the Byzantine twists and turns of his plots and the myriad references hidden in the text to other masters of the genre like Agatha Christie and Arthur Conan Doyle. We spoke with him in 2017 about the Magpie Murders, which featured literary agent Susan Ryland as a sleuth who finds her clues in a novel within a novel, written by her client Alan Conway and featuring another sleuth, Atticus Punt. Now Horowitz is back with a sequel, The Moonflower Murders, also a book with a novel within a novel. And it's just as delightful a read as the first. Anthony Horowitz, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
It's a real pleasure to be talking to you again.
So The Moonflower Murders, this is a sequel to The Magpie Murders. Susan Ryland is back as a sleuth. Tell us a little bit about her and set the story up for us. And also tell us, of course, about Alan Conway.
Certainly. Susan Ryland, she's a fun character to write about because she's not a detective. She's an editor, a publishing editor. And at the end of Magpie Murders, she sort of retired, was forced into retirement on the island of Crete in Greece. And the new book, Moonflower Murders, finds her running a hotel with her long-term boyfriend, Andreas. And they're short of cash. And one day, a couple turn up at the hotel with a strange story. Their daughter has gone missing. But before the daughter went missing, the daughter said that she was certain that a murder committed 9 years ago before had resulted in the wrong person being arrested. And the only clue that this couple has as to how this daughter got this information is contained in a book written by a man called Alan Conway, which Susan published and edited. And so Susan's job in this new book is to read this book, which is contained in its entirety within Moonflower Murders, and also to travel back to the United Kingdom to visit the hotel where this murder took place and to try and work out who is the killer. I hope that makes sense. It's always more difficult to explain than it is to read.
Now, we also have to mention that Alan Conway is dead.
Alan Conway is a particularly unpleasant writer who worked with our Susan for many years. He was the best-selling author of 9 novels starring a detective called Atticus Punt. And he and Susan had a very difficult relationship. And in the course of Magpie Murders, the first book in this sequel, Alan Conway did in fact die, and it was found to have been murdered. And I should say at once that you don't have to have read Magpie Murders to read Moonflower Murders. They are 2 standalone novels.
Tell me, is Susan Ryland your first female sleuth?
Do you know, I think she is. It's a terrible thing to say, although I haven't created that many sleuths. You know, I've written Sherlock Holmes and I've written Poirot. I created a character called Daniel Hawthorne, who is a detective. I've now written 3 books about him. So, yes, she is. And I should have done it before because I absolutely love writing in her voice.
So say more about that. Why do you love writing in her voice?
Well, I think, first of all, as I said, she's not a detective, she's an editor. And I love her point of view, the way she sees the world through books and through writing and through literature. And I really like that. But also, I don't quite know what it is about writing across the genders, but I feel that she has an independence of spirit because she is not the same gender as me. I don't know if that makes any sense or not, but when I'm writing her, you know, she almost... I hate to say this, she almost tells me what to write. And I like that. I like following in her footsteps and listening to her voice.
So you kind of channel her in a way.
Well, is it that? I don't know. I think that, I am married to a very strong, independent woman. My wife, Jill Green, is the producer of Foyle's War, and we've worked together for a long time. As it happens, the editor on whom Susan Ryland is based, a lady by the name of Susan Lamb, was a very good friend of mine too. And I guess there is something in me that my best work has been brought out by smart women. And so when I'm writing Susan Ryland, that's what happens. And I think that the book is all the better for having her in it.
And not to belabor the point, you know, there is a kind of sub-thread in the book where she's wondering whether or not she's going to actually stay with her boyfriend. And I found that, you know, as a woman, had a lot of verisimilitude.
Well, you know, I like the fact that I was able to write, which is unusual for me, because, you know, I write so much that is murder mystery, or my YA books are always full of action and adventure. It's really enjoyable for me and a new territory to sit and write about relationships, about how people feel. And it's absolutely true that while Susan is investigating this murder in England, she is constantly worrying about her relationship with Andreas and whether it is going to continue or not. And, you know, that to me has been a real discovery, that I can write this sort of stuff, as well as writing clues and suspects and red herrings and all the rest of it.
Yes, and I think that really did add another dimension to the story, as does the story within a story. This is also like the Magpie Murders. It has a book within a book. This one, it's Atticus Punt Takes the Case. For those of our listeners who may not know who Atticus Punt is, tell us a little bit about this fictional sleuth.
He is the detective invented by Alan Conway, who was Susan's client and an author, not, as I say, not a very nice author. But Atticus Punt is a very warm character. He obviously has some sort of relationship to Hercule Poirot. I mean, he is the outsider. He is an immigrant to Britain. But I think he's a little more serious in some ways than Poirot. He is a Greek Jew who was caught up in the war when he was in Germany and found himself in a labor camp. He has lost a great number of his family in the Holocaust, and this has given him a front seat in the theater of evil, which is actually how he might have put it in the book that he's been writing all his life. He's been working on a book called Landmarks of Criminal Investigation, which is his sort of his great opus of his life. And he's a serious character, but I hope a likable one and not too eccentric.
Yes, and as you point out, he's post-war. This is just post-war. This takes place in the 1950s. That is a story within the story, not the first story, but the second story. And at some point, you talk about, or you're, it gets complicated, doesn't it? Let's say that Alan Conway prefers to set his stories in the 1950s, and that's for a particular reason. So tell us that.
Well, he has this sort of love of golden age detective fiction, as I have to say, do I. And I think that what is appealing about that particular period is, first of all, the pace. You know, you don't have our cell phones, you don't have the internet. Information has to be worked out cerebrally in the head. You can't just press a button on your computer and know everything immediately. There are much fewer forensics. For me, the joy of a murder mystery comes from working something out, as Holmes does, sitting in his chair with his pipe with a fire blazing, rather than getting a report from the medical officer, which tells you that, you know, something strange, you know, but a poison has been administered, or that whatever has happened to the human body. And I also like very much the elegance of that world, but sort of the gentility of it, particularly now, I think, living in the times we do, where everything seems to have become so aggressive, where people in their communications with each other are so abrupt and so harsh. I do love a world of gentility and civility, even if it is a world that is inspired by murder.
And also, it's of course, very key when you talked about you can't go on the internet for clues. Well, Susan Ryland, who is completely contemporary, also, if I remember correctly, doesn't really go on the internet for clues. She goes into this fictional novel, the novel within the novel. So talk about constructing two entire novels at the same time and how you work them together.
Well, I start with the modern novel, the because that's the beginning of the book, and I like to try and write forwards. It does instead take an enormous amount of planning. I would say I probably spent as much time planning Moonflower Murders as writing it. And the for me, what is absolutely the most important thing of all is that it should be an easy read. I personally do not like reading murder mystery when I get to page 107. I'm wondering who is this character? What is his or her relationship to the person who was killed? Why is it important that they were in the house at 9 o'clock at night? All that sort of stuff. I like everything to be an easy read and a fun read. So it takes a lot of planning to make that happen. But I start with the modern murder because that's where Alan Conway starts. Alan Conway visits a hotel where somebody has been killed. And somehow, we don't know how, Alan Conway solves that murder and hides the solution of it inside a book. So then I move into the book that he has written. And what I think is fun in Moonflower Murders is that all the characters that he has met in the modern world turn up in sort of forms of themselves inside the book. He turns them into characters or even caricatures. So I had to begin with the characters to know what Alan Conway would do with them, and that's how I wrote the book. But then sewing it up at the end is complicated, and it sort of requires, I often feel like a telephone engineer at the end of these books, and I'm holding in my left hand 100 wires and in my right hand 100 wires, and somehow these have all got to connect together so that we can make the call.
Yes. And, the final scene is very much like, of course, we won't reveal anything about it other than that it is the classic Agatha Christie, everybody gets together. And Susan Ryland goes step by step, and it's so interesting because, I found myself thinking, is it this one? Oh, okay. No, there's more. No, maybe it's this one. So I think that was really quite well done.
Thank you so much, Francesca. But what gave me the greatest pleasure was that even when the whole thing seems to be wrapped up and that both the murders have been solved, because of course you've got a double set of murders, the murders in the Golden Age book and the murders in the modern world. But even when that's all been done and Susan's returned to Crete, there are still this whole raft of clues that suddenly appear with a final twist, which I'm happy to say nobody has yet managed to spot. And writing it just gave me such a big smile to know that all these things have been planted in the book and that hopefully readers, and so far no readers have managed to spot them.
As we've spoken about, the book is a tribute to the Golden Age of crime novels, but it also delves into some contemporary issues like gay culture and also how immigrants are treated in the UK. So let's take the first one first. Alan Conway is gay. Talk a little bit about incorporating that theme of gay culture and even some more unconventional parts of gay culture into this book.
Well, in fact, it's not just Alan Conway. It's his partner, James, who also appears in the books as the sidekick under different names, James Fraser in real life. No, James Taylor in real life, James Fraser in the books. Has a background in sort of the slightly more sordid world of sort of gay culture, which is sort of the bars and sort of rent boys and the sort of the dark side, if you like, of that culture. But I hope that the view of gay life in the books is simply, I think that where we are now in 2020, the fact that a character is gay or that there is a gay theme in the book shouldn't raise an eyebrow. Lots of people are. So what is my view? I should also add that, these books do not contain physicality. I'm not particularly interested in describing, the act of love, gay or straight. It's just not what I do. But what I like about the books is that it is just one of the threads that goes through it and doesn't really need any comment from me. I am not proselytizing. I'm not saying anything political or socially sort of, loaded. I am just describing life as it is.
Yes, exactly. And I think that is, in not being remarkable, it does show us a bit of where we are as, say, compared to the world of Atticus Punt.
Well, I think that's right. And I think what is nice is that, you were talking earlier about Susan and her attitudes. one of the people to whom she is definitely closest in both books, Moonflower Murders and Before Bessie Magpie Murders, is this young man, James Fraser, who is a bit of a, James Taylor, sorry, I keep getting my names wrong, James Taylor in Modern Life, who is a bit of a reprobate and a bit of a rogue and you know, and is quite sort of out there, so to speak. But I rather like the fact that she befriends him and sees the best in him, and his sexuality is not relevant to her. He is just somebody who helps her, and they do have, you know, a couple of scenes together, which I think are quite warm.
Now, the other issue is immigration, and that, you know, without belaboring or making any kind of political point, you really do introduce this thread of how anti-immigrant feeling is so prevalent in England, and how, you know, just like in America, you know, is involved with imprisoning people who are immigrants or the other, quote unquote.
Well, the story you're referring to is a major part of Moonflower Murders, which is that the wrong person has been arrested, and that person happens to be from Eastern Europe, and the fact of his ethnicity and his origins has upset, or seems possibly to have angered the police, who may therefore have loaded the dice against him. And again, it is not, I think, my job to make any comment on this, other than to say that anybody reading that story in the United Kingdom isn't going to say, hey, what's this guy going on about? That never happens here. They're simply going to recognize that, unfortunately, it happens all too often on both sides of the Atlantic. But again, you know, we are talking, obviously, in a week where significant things have happened on the world stage, and I live in the hope that as I get older and time moves on, that attitudes can and will change, and that the sort of attitudes that we have seen both in America and in the United Kingdom. Only today, a member of the House of Lords is all over Twitter, having tweeted something really shocking, in my view, about Kamala Harris. And I looked at this tweet and I thought to myself, my God, are you living in the 19th century? Are you not awake to what is happening in the world right now? And so instead of feeling anger or hostility towards this Lord, I feel a certain degree of pity. And I think that is the way we are moving now in terms of immigration. I think that the events of this week and the way the world is going means that, you know, there are sea changes coming, I think, faster perhaps than anybody realizes. Things are getting better.
So back to Moonflower Murders. Is there going to be a sequel to this as well?
Before I answer that question, I will say you have taken me further down political corridors than I normally like to go, because I know that my place in this world is merely as an entertainer and a writer of murder mysteries, and I really do not have a political drum which I try to beat in these books. However, in answer to your question now, I think I might do one more. Magpie Murders is being filmed next year in February. We have a wonderful piece of casting. I'm sorry I can't share the name with you for Susan Ryland, but it's another reason why I'm so happy with that character, that it has attracted major talent to the show, and once the contracts have been signed and everything is absolutely sealed, of course, we'll make announcements. Because of that, that's one of the reasons why I wrote Moonflower Murders, because we needed to have a sequel for television. And if the two shows do well, then yes, I think there is probably one more book about Susan Ryland in me. Not more, because I don't think I can keep, you know, finding variations on this same trick of the book within the book. But I have had one more idea. I bounced off my wife only a couple of nights ago, actually, and she loved it. So I think I'm going to write it.
Oh, that's great. And perhaps we'll talk with you about that one as well.
I do hope so. My conversations with you are always such a pleasure.
Oh, and same here. Thank you so much, Anthony Horowitz, for talking with us about your latest, the second in what may be three, Moonflower Murders. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Francesca.
Master of Crime Fiction, Anthony Horowitz. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to an audio sample of The Moonflower Murders. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.